All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is the Thursday, October 22nd afternoon section of the Portland City Council. Good afternoon. Keelan, welcome. Please call the roll.
Good afternoon. Mayor Daley?
Fritz? Here.
Ryan?
Here.
Hardesty?
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Am I the only one getting an echo, or is anybody else hearing an echo?
I'm hearing an echo.
Same.
Me too.
I hear an echo, and I'm also here.
Okay. And it sounds like it just got fixed. So we're through that. Good afternoon, everybody. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the council are attending remotely by video and teleconference. The city is making several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. That includes availability on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. I want to continue to thank everybody for your patience, your flexibility, and your understanding as we manage through what is obviously a trying time to conduct the city's business. And with that, Keelan, I want to make a housekeeping announcement right up front. If there's anybody on the line waiting for item 844, which is our second time certain item at 3:30, we are not going to hear that today. And I'll make an announcement later about that, but we are pulling that back to our office for a later day. That's item 844 relating to adopting code and administration rules for the COEP program. So with that, we'll get to the one item this afternoon. It's a time certain 2 p.m. item 843 brought by the auditor. Keelan, can you please read it for us?
Report on recent work from the city auditor, including groundwater, enhanced service districts, equity, and construction contracting.
Good afternoon, Madam Auditor. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero. And the three reports that we are presenting today represent performance audits of the city's management of our backup source of drinking water, the oversight of city authorized districts that raise money to provide extra public services within their boundaries, and the effectiveness of city council, council's initiatives to use the city's immense purchasing power to correct race and gender disparities in construction contracting. The last two audits reflect our intention to include community expectations and experiences in our work where possible. Concerns voiced during our outreach engagements by those who experience the adverse effects of enhanced service districts and construction contracting initiatives inform the selection and scope of those two audits. And given the unnerving times we are in, who wouldn't like some assurance that the city's management of our backup drinking water source isn't perfect, but is operating under the attentive eye of managers who know its vulnerabilities and are working to shore up some of them. Performance Auditor Martha Prinz will present the results of our audit of the city's management of our groundwater system. Then Alexander Furchak will present the results of our audit of the city's oversight of enhanced service districts. And Elizabeth Pape and Gordon Friedman will go over our audit of the city's equitable construction contracting initiatives. Before we begin, I'd like to invite you to ask questions after each presentation before we proceed to the next one. We've reserved some extra time today so that you should have plenty of time for questions. And so if you are ready, we'll get started with our groundwater management audit.
Thank you, Madam Auditor. And just a housekeeping note, to my eye, the briefing looks like it's tiny. Is there some way to make that larger, or is that something on my screen?
No, I think that's me. I'm sorry. Hi, I'm Martha Prinz. I'm going to try to, despite all my practice, You know how this is. I'm going to try to do that better.
Thanks, Mark.
So
appreciate
bear
it.
With me.
No worries.
I still need to break. Sorry, one second here.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, Matt.
This is Matt. Yeah, I would assume that this might be a good juncture to read the city attorney's statement on conduct if we're going to...
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm sorry, Matt. I forgot about that. So why don't you go ahead and read that?
Okay.
And Martha, keep working on the technology here.
Okay. Perfect. Okay. I apologize.
No worries. So to participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the city council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Back to you, Martha.
Okay. So are you able to see my slideshow now?
Yeah, that looks good. Thank you.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. You know how that is. So with that introduction by Mary, I'll just launch right in. Good afternoon. My name is Martha Prince, and I'm going to be talking about our audit of the city's management of the groundwater system. And this audit was released in June of this year. And the audit found that the city had identified risks to the system and needed to develop a long-term plan to address those risks. Portland gets its water from two sources. This is a photo of the very photogenic primary water source, Bull Run, which has been in use since 1895, and it's about 30 miles east of Portland. Bull Run watershed gets most of its water from rainfall, and the water flows to Portland by gravity. Portland's secondary water system, which is not quite as photogenic, is the groundwater system. What we're looking at here is a groundwater storage tank located at the Water Bureau's groundwater facility, where groundwater is stored and treated. The groundwater system was developed in the 1980s at a time when floods, landslides, reduced clarity in the city's drinking water reservoirs, and growing demands for water led the city to drill wells into aquifers along the Columbia River to develop a secondary water source. Aquifers are underground layers of permeable rock that water can flow through. Unlike the gravity-fed Bull Run, the water in the groundwater system needs to be pumped out of the ground, so there are a lot more moving parts involved. The area where the groundwater wells are located is known as the Columbia South Shore Well Field. The groundwater system is the second largest water source in Oregon after Bull Run. And there are two types of situations where groundwater is used. There might be a heavy storm in the winter or a wildfire or some other reason why the water in the reservoirs is too cloudy to safely drink. And in that case, we might replace Bull Run water with groundwater. And the second time that the city needs groundwater is when Portland's water needs are projected to exceed the capacity of the Bull Run system, for example, during a stretch of hot weather. And of course, we're having more and more hot summers than we used to. And in that situation, groundwater can be used to supplement Bull Run water. The groundwater system gets a lot less attention than Bull Run, which is part of the reason we wanted to ask how well the Water Bureau is managing this equally important water system. Managing the groundwater system can be challenging for a lot of reasons. One of those has to do with the fact that it's used only sporadically. This chart gives you an idea of some of that variability. And we can see here that 2015 and 2018 were times of high use. And there was a lot of demand those years due to hot summers that we had then. But in any given year, it's really impossible to predict with precision what the demands on groundwater will be. So it's a system that needs to be ready to go at all times with all of the moving parts and other systems that are involved. Sort of like a car in your garage that you need to maintain, even though you might not use it all the time. Just it has to be ready. Our audit found the Bureau has work underway in each of these four critical areas, each of which has multiple components within it. In some cases, we found the Bureau's response was somewhat lagging. And the reality is that there are limited resources to address issues even once they've been identified. The Bureau prioritized groundwater in a recent comprehensive strategic plan, acknowledging the system could benefit from additional attention. I'll just run through a few examples in each of these areas. The strains on the water quality, The strains on the water quality of the system are primarily from manganese, which is a naturally occurring mineral, and also from a group of human-made chemicals called PFAS. The Bureau is working on a plan to deal with manganese, which is particularly pressing because it's intruding into some of the highest producing groundwater wells. PFAS aren't regulated now, but they might be soon. In terms of capacity planning, with increasingly hot summers in recent years, as well as some other issues, the Bureau realized they needed to get a better handle on how much water the groundwater system can provide, taking climate, contaminants, and other factors into consideration. They're working on increasing their understanding of both current and future capacity, and at the time of our audit, they were in the process of hiring a hydrogeologist to help with that. Obviously, we all know seismic preparedness is a big issue here in the Pacific Northwest, and the Bureau is focusing on the most important pipes throughout the whole water system in terms of hardening the system. Addressing the seismic needs of the groundwater system is estimated to cost about $200 million, and it's considered a medium priority, with other Bureau projects being a higher priority. The Bureau recently developed a plan for specific actions to take within the first hours after a major earthquake to stabilize the water system. And the Bureau told us that preparing for a large earthquake helps them prepare for other types of emergencies as well. Finally, in terms of asset management, apart from setting aside seismic needs, a draft asset management plan for groundwater, it was in draft form at the time of our audit, I'm not sure where it is now, showed some degree of unmet needs, especially in the out years. And of course, those needs might grow depending on how the Bureau decides to deal with manganese and any other issues that aren't currently anticipated. Finally, the last challenge I'll talk about for the groundwater system is that it's inherently an interdisciplinary system, and the Bureau has chosen a decentralized approach to managing it. The benefit of that approach is that no one area of expertise is elevated over any other area, but the lack of a single coordinator whose sole focus is groundwater might make decisions take longer and might pose some other challenges as well. Our first recommendation was for the Water Bureau to focus on clarifying and documenting how decisions are made and how the groundwater program is organized. Our other recommendation is for the Bureau to document all the needs of the groundwater system so that a plan can be developed that brings those needs together into one place. Those needs should also be prioritized, which is especially important in a time of limited resources. In response to the audit, the Water Bureau said that overall they agreed with our assessments and would work to address our recommendations. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Colleagues, any questions? I want to thank you, Auditor Prince, for starting the presentation off the way you did by explaining at the very rudimentary level how our water system works. That was actually an excellent description, and I think a lot of Portlanders are very surprised to learn the sources of our water system. And I learn something new every time I hear presentations like this. And what I learned, did you say the groundwater system was not established till the 1980s, or did I misunderstand this? Right. That is remarkable to me.
Yeah, no, really, it truly is, yeah.
Did you evaluate emergency preparedness? Obviously, we had a scare a couple of years ago when we had the Columbia River Gorge fire spreading over the ridge towards our primary water source, Bull Run. Ultimately, it didn't get there, and emergency crews were able to put a break in place that would have potentially helped stop the fire. But obviously, that was a wake-up moment for all of us. Did you look at aspects like that, or was that beyond the scope of this particular audit?
Well, we didn't go into depth. I mean, obviously, and that's one of the great things about this job is you're learning so many things. With the fires this summer, that does make you think about, you know, something could happen. I did talk a little bit to some folks about fire. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely something to consider for sure.
And the way I interpreted your comments about the Bureau, it sounds like they don't disagree with your audit findings. Were there any areas, therefore, that they said, we don't disagree, but it will be difficult for us to implement? Were there areas like that you'd want to highlight for the council today?
No, that didn't come up. I just think, I mean, just and it's reflected in the report, there are just so very many needs. So, I mean, that's part of, you know, part of the point of the report was sort of to elevate, and it's just that a lot of people don't even know that there is a groundwater system or how it works. And so I did want to go ahead and explain that in this report, because I do think part
good.
Of this
and,
is sort of
and you
public
found
education.
The Bureau, oh, sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's my fault. You found the Bureau responsive to your information requests and data requests?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, it was great.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. That completes my question. I don't know if anybody else has a question on this particular audit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Martha, and thanks for dealing with the technology. You did better than most of us would.
You always think that's not gonna happen when you go to present, but
it always does.
It always does. Oh, thanks for your patience.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good job.
And now we're ready for enhanced service districts.
Okay. Can you see my screen okay?
Yeah, okay. Looks good. Looks real good.
Okay, my name is Alexander Ferchak, and I will present the audit of Enhanced Services District, where we found that the city provides a little oversight of services funded and provided by these districts. We assess the city's role in creating the districts and also monitoring district activities, and we concluded that the city's hands-off approach may lead to disparate law enforcement outcomes and limits community members' ability to influence district activities and also to monitor the results. Enhanced services districts are also in other cities are often known as business improvement districts. They are areas where businesses or property owners pay an extra fee in order to fund services that are supplemental to those provided by the city. There are three districts in Portland: Clean and Safe, Lloyd District, and Central East Side. In Portland, this fee from the districts is collected by the city's revenue department, and then the department distributes the fees to a nonprofit organization to manage the district and fund the services. The city also has agreements with each district that outline fee collection process, scope of services to be provided, and also various oversight requirements. The districts are very different in their budget size, their scope of services they provide, and also management structure. The Downtown Clean and Safe District is managed by the Portland Business Alliance. It is the largest and also the oldest district in Portland. It has an annual budget of $5 million. District services include cleaning of streets and sidewalks, public safety, and also business development. The Lloyd District, which is managed by Go Lloyd, has an annual budget of $0.5 million. Now, Lloyd focuses mainly on transportation incentives. The newest district, which is Central East Side, is managed by the Central East Side Industrial Council, and it has an annual budget of about $3 million. The DIS district also includes security services, street cleaning, and graffiti removal. Now, why is oversight important? It's important because the districts fund services that have an impact on the public. These services include armed and unarmed security officers that patrol the streets, and it also includes street maintenance services, such as picking up waste and cleaning sidewalks. Some districts have also funded their district attorney offices and community courts. Clean and Safe also funds four Portland police officers who work with the private security officers in order to enforce the downtown Clean and Safe district. The Portland police coordinate with the security officers to respond to complaints from district businesses and residents, and the private security firm provides a phone number for the community to call, and the security firm dispatches officers in order to respond to these calls that are coming in. District activities, by their design, really create a different level of service than in other areas of the city. And although many may value the litter and graffiti removal or park maintenance, some of the district activities are not benign to some community members, such as, for example, when someone is confronted by a district security officer. These enhance law enforcement or criminal justice services create a risk of disparate outcomes compared to other parts of the city. City oversight of these services is critical. For example, there is no oversight of how the armed officers are trained, or there's no accountable process for complaints about private security officers. Now, the oversight that has been put in place up until now is in fact not completed by the city. The city's revenue division is charged with overseeing the district activities and also managing the agreements between the city and the district. And according to those agreements that are currently in place, revenue is to review annual budgets, audits of the district, scope of services that they provide. But we found that districts completed the required reporting, such as the audits, but revenue did not collect or review these reports. Now, revenue managers said that they collect and administer the district fees, but they are not best suited to provide oversight or even to comment on district activities and their budgets. Revenue also did not initiate a revision of the agreements in order to shift this responsibility. City agreements with the districts also state that the city police commissioner will obtain and review reports on security officers' activities. Now, this includes complaints against the security officers and also the resulting investigations. But we did not find evidence that these reports are being collected and reviewed in order to provide this needed oversight. We also found that there are no guidelines for district formation or the governance of these districts.
Excuse me, Alexandra, could we go back to the previous chart for just a sec, please?
Commissioner Hardesty, could I suggest we go through the presentation and then leave the Q&A for the end, unless it's burning?
Okay, I will do that.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I'll call you first.
So as far as guidelines, we found that there are no guidelines for district formation or the governance of these districts. There's no guidance to ensure that, for example, interests of small or large businesses are protected, or whether the districts are inclusive and transparent. When Central Eastside, which is the newest district, when it was recently formed, they found it very difficult to navigate the city's process because there was very little guidance about how to structure district management and also the governance. Extensive public input and also pressure led the district to create an inclusive and transparent governance structure in order to ensure that all community members were considered when the district is developing and choosing the services that they're going to fund. The other two districts don't have a similar inclusive governance processes, and it is also not a city requirement at this moment. So the lack of oversight by the city makes it difficult for community members to find information about these districts, and it's really left up to the districts of how much they actually share of that information. For example, in 2019, Advocates for the Houseless People submitted a public records request in order to learn about Clean and Safe District function, their budgets, audits completed, and even their subcontractors. The city didn't provide all the requested documentation because the city didn't have this information. So as you can see, if the city does not obtain that information from the district, there's really no process for the public to obtain the records about the district and their private sector providers. So what we recommend that the Office of Management and Finance work with council to really review the process of the districts and the city's responsibility for them. If the review concludes that districts should continue to provide services in public spaces and really services that are impacting the general public, that district, then the city should develop clear guidelines for district formation, governance, and management. And these guidelines should ensure public input, transparency, and accountability by the district. We also recommend that the city revisit the district agreements. These agreements are renewed every 10 years, but we have not really seen significant revisions to the content of the agreements, and the agreements should really be lined up with what is the purpose that council designates for these districts. And finally, we recommend that the city develop an effective process for city oversight of district services and their activities. It should include a project manager or some type of a liaison over the districts and ongoing reporting of district activities to council and the public, including reporting of security and law enforcement activities. So the Office of Management and Finance largely agreed with our recommendations. They stated that the city is not fully recovering district administration costs, and costs have been intentionally kept low in order to maximize available resources for the district services. They also stated the revenue division is not suitable to administer the district contracts and to provide this needed oversight. And that since really the districts have grown in size and also in scope, having a dedicated district manager would be appropriate. So that concludes my presentation, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty had her hand up first, then Commissioner Daly.
Thank you so much, Alexandra, for that very succinct but troubling report. My first question is really around, so let me back up a bit. So I'm concerned that there are different levels of access to the DA and to police based on based on people raising money within the district and being able to spend that money as they see fit. And so you talked about private security. Is there even a mechanism for people to complain about the actions of private security? And if so, where does that happen?
Yeah, there is currently, I'm not sure you can call it a mechanism, but for example, somebody, you know, who's confronted by a private security officer, they can call the private security firm phone number and complain about that particular security officers. The question is what happens to that complaint and how is it investigated? And right, that information is not being forwarded to the city or not being reviewed by the city on a consistent basis.
Well, I share your concern about that. I'm also concerned that we have we are raising money and giving it to a private entity that hires police and have access to DAs in ways that the general public does not have. I know the Lloyd, Go Lloyd district pays for a assistant DA, and they also have staff to assist them in prosecuting community members in the Lloyd district. But I, do we know, how do we get access to that data about who's being prosecuted through these enhanced service districts? What's the demographic breakdown of the people being prosecuted? And what are the outcome of those cases?
Yeah, that's data that you would probably have to go to the DA's office at the county level and see really what the arrests are, you know, what the outcomes of those arrests are, and that would be something to maybe in the future to take a look at and compare it to other parts of the city. Yeah,
I'm surprised that's not any agreement that we would have annual report backs about that data. I'm very troubled. I read this audit and I was like, it can't be that bad, but apparently it is. So my next question is, why is the city not recovering its costs as is related to these enhanced service districts?
Yeah, the reason they gave us that for not recovering full costs is that, again, they wanted to make sure that they keep the administrative costs low and that so that, you know, more money is spent on actual district services. But this would be also something that the revenue division could take a look at to, you know, assess really what is even the cost of administering these districts. And, you know, as they stated, if you add a district management office or a manager or some kind of a liaison, that's going to increase the district administration costs. But yes, the city, obviously, if the city is involved in collecting the fees and then distributing the fees, there's quite a work involved for the city. Cost to the city, yes.
Well, especially when the districts combined is $8.5 million that's being spent on, I'm assuming, the city's behalf. The city's collecting those dollars, the city's distributing those dollars, but basically it's kind of a free-for-all. They do what they want to do with it and we don't question it. I just have so many questions. I'm going to stop because I know my colleagues also have questions and I will probably come back at done. So thank you. Thank you for this very detailed audit. And let me just say that it troubles me greatly that these enhanced service districts, these are not the complaints that you have heard from houseless community members are not new. These are complaints that I've been hearing for at least 15 years solid. People continue to ask, where do I go to complain? And no one ever gives a really good answer. I'm also very concerned that it says in your audit that we have Portland police officers working for private security firms. How does that work?
Yeah, so currently the way the contract between the City of Portland and Clean and Safe, and then also there's a contract between Clean and Safe and the private security firm, those two contracts currently state that the City of Portland police officers that are funded by Clean and Safe will work together with the private security officers. Something we were trying to determine and look at is what's the sort of reporting authority there. And way, if you look at the agreement, the language is somewhat vague. So the supervision of these Portland police officers could be within the Portland police or within the security firm. It is a bit vague. And we didn't look into detail and exactly how this is working, but this is something that, again, council should look at those contracts to make sure that it clarifies, you know, what is the supervision requirements? Who do the police officers report to? You know, who has really authority over their assignments, how they are assigned, or even how they're selected? Work with the Clean and Safe district. Yeah, so that's important for us. For us, it was a bit difficult to even assess what is the city looking for there. Yeah.
And one last question about, I think you may have just answered this question, but so it's unclear who the Portland police officers report to and who the authority is given to when these four police officers are working on behalf of Clean and Safe. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, when we interviewed the Portland police,
police regarding this, they will say, well, of course, the Portland police officers, report to their sergeant. But in practice, the question is, how does it really work in practice? And what's the oversight of that? Who's really looking at this? How does it work on the ground? That's really important.
So again, are there 4 police officers assigned full time to clean and save?
Yes.
And so my last question is about procedural justice. These districts that have the ability to both have their own police and their own DA, that to me sounds like that there are some parts of the city that have more access to our justice system than other parts of the city. Is that a best practice that you would give some small groups more access to justice than others?
I would say it's a bit of an overstatement to say that they have their own DAs. What they do is they provide some funding, or provided in the past some funding.
I know the Lloyd Center does have an assistant DA that they pay for that works out of the Lloyd District. So that is not an overstatement at all.
Right. But the DA doesn't just work within just for the Lloyd District, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is that the districts provide some funding to the DA's offices. And in the past, they've also funded community courts. And the question around that is, is that best practice or not? But the question really is, when you provide funding, then that gives you obviously increased access, it gives you some authority, it gives you influence over that office. And that's really the key question. How much funding do they provide? How does it work? What do they get for that? That's the question.
Yeah. That is a huge question. Yeah. Thank you. I'll stop there. I know my colleagues have questions.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for continuing with your questions, Commissioner Hardesty. Hopefully my sneezing fit has passed. I'll be able to get the words out. I do have longstanding concerns and a lengthy list of questions, which I am not going to ask everyone in this session today. I think I'll just follow up outside of session. But I'm wondering if you can give us a sense. I know that enhanced service districts are partially funded by additional, I think, taxes that property owners agree to pay. Is that how it's collected?
Yes, although the wording here is important because it's not really a tax. So it's not a tax at all. It's a fee. And what's the difference is that, the members of this district really have agreed to form a district and pay this fee. And there is an agreement that this district can be dissolved at any time if a certain amount of the members don't agree to it. So it's not a tax, it's really a fee, sort of, you can consider it a fee for service. In city code, it's actually considered a property management fee, which is how it's classified, yeah.
Sorry, all right. So what percentage of the total cost is covered by those additional fees that the property owners own? I'm sure it varies, but... And with the Central East side, which I want to express my cautious optimism about, because we worked closely with CEIC, my office, Commissioner Hardesty's office, and community members to really create a new model for ESDs and work directly with impacted communities, including representatives from the homeless community. And PBOT updated its guidelines on what parking revenue could be spent on, because in Central East Side, that is parking revenue is a portion of what funds the ESD, unlike the other two. So, sorry, can you give me a sense of what portion they're paying for and what we're backfilling?
So your question for backfilling, are you talking about money that's coming out of city budget?
Right. You said that we're not doing full cost recovery. So mm-hmm. we know what their total budgets are. What portion are covered by?
Yeah, that would be a good question for revenue division.
Okay, revenue.
Exactly. Okay. What the exact cost is for administering these districts. I'm not certain if they, I think at the time of the audit, they weren't really assessing that, but that may be something to ask them about to make sure, because I probably wouldn't be the right person to answer that.
Okay, that's fine.
Actually providing, yeah. But then to your other question, what we're focused on is the money that comes out of the fee collection. But you are correct that the districts also sometimes have other sources of revenue. So for example, you know, Central East Side does have some PBOD money coming in, or Clean and Safe may have some other sources of fund, like maybe for the Portland, Prosper Portland. So yeah, there are various sources. And those are sort of creating conjunction with, like, for example, Portland Business Alliance. Yeah, we really focused on that, on the fee district, fee revenue. Yeah.
And can you tell me how much of the budget from each of the ESDs goes towards private security? Or are these just two technical questions about?
I think we included that in our audit report, but it depends on the district. For example, for Clean and Safe, it is the majority of their budget. So yeah, it is a substantial amount that goes into security contracts. Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned just a lack of oversight at the city level and challenges with the Revenue Bureau. Does Prosper Portland have any kind of relationship to the ESDs and their managing associations?
Yes. So the districts, I believe both, I know for sure that Clean and Safe, the downtown district, has a contract with Prosper Portland. I believe so does Central East Side. But yes, they have a pretty, there's a lot of different relationships, I guess you could call them, contract, various city bureaus. Yes.
Okay. I do think that a lot of my questions are a little too detailed and technical. So I will follow up with the appropriate bureaus, but I do want to just mention that these contracts come up for renewal, and we are not wedded to who administrates, who the managing organization is. And it's, I think, high time for a conversation about.
Yeah, and actually, Clean and Safe is coming up for renewal next year. I think Lloyd is the following year. So this is good timing to review those. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. This was incredibly helpful.
You're welcome.
Could I ask you just a couple of questions? I don't see other hands raised at the moment, so I'll jump in here. You mentioned required reporting. What reporting is required, and where do those requirements derive from?
Mm-hmm. So the reporting, the ones that we are referring to that are currently in place are all listed in the agreement between the city and the districts. And then there's also agreements between the districts and their service providers. So for example, between the security firm. So there are pretty clear sort of guidelines in those contracts of this sort of reporting that should be provided to the city. Some of that includes, you know, submitting annual budgets for the districts. I mentioned the complaints against security officers and the resulting investigations. So those would be examples of reporting by the districts to the city. Currently, you know, what we have seen is that there's really no consistent review of those. There may have been examples in the past when revenue has asked for those, but there's really just no consistent, you know, request of those reports and review of those reports.
Let me ask you a broader question, and I appreciate you raising this. I mean, first of all, I'll be clear. I think there are many benefits to the service districts, and I appreciate what Commissioner Udaly said earlier. I don't view all of these the same. Some of these are very old legacy contracts. The work with the Central East Side Industrial District is, you know, the ink is still wet on that agreement. And that was seen as being a very community-focused effort, and there were some real innovations there. And at the time that we held hearings on that and approved it, we declared that really represented a new high bar for how ESD should look and how the community should be engaged going forward. And my informal conversations with people lead me to believe that so far that arrangement has worked really well. So I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, and I want people to understand there has been evolution here as far as the formation of the ESDs. But my larger question is this. I know a lot of the audit reports that I get back say things very similar to what this audit report says in terms of there is basic information that is not hard to collect, that is asked for in the agreement that the city signs, and then we don't collect it. And part of what I think is happening here, and I'm just gonna put an idea on the table and you can shoot it down or support it or whatever, we sort of shoehorn various contracts into various bureaus, and they don't shoehorn in very well. And what happens is the bureaus that frankly have other higher level strategic imperatives push this work to the side. And you've got the revenue bureau whose job it is to collect and distribute revenues. And they have all of their systems in alignment to collect and distribute revenues. And even in your audit, you say they're really good at that. But then when it comes to who's overseeing the security guards, that doesn't fit very neatly with the Bureau of Revenue in the Office of Management and Finance here in the city of Portland. So I think part of the problem is we need a larger conversation about accountability and oversight. Who collects the data? Where does the data reside? And how does that data then get filtered out to all of us as commissioners and bureau directors and others who, I'm guessing, when they read your initial audit, or when you asked the questions, they went, huh, I didn't know I was supposed to be doing that. Did you get some of that? Or what happened here? Why is required reporting not being done? Why not?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something we actually see very often in auditing, is that, you know, you put in together a contract, or you pass a ballot measure, and there's requirements in there for monitoring and oversight. And that oftentimes, like you're saying, falls off, because nobody really is tasked with that duty to really monitor and oversee. And so, and to be fair to revenue, they did know about all these requirements. They did know about the contracts. But they really said, you know, how do we even assess what services should be provided? It does make sense that it is not in their, they're really not the ideal bureau to be doing this. Yeah.
Is there a way, Alexandra, because I think you've narrowed in on a really important point. And I appreciate, by the way, the bureau's response to this, saying, yeah, pretty much you're right. And we need to do better. But I think we need to spend some time talking about how we are going to do better. Because I think administratively, under this form of government and the separation of bureaus and the different data management systems that we're using across bureaus, we're going to continue to have this problem unless somebody does something fairly dramatically different. Is there a way, for example, with the current systems that we have in place, could we create sort of a central repository of all required data collection for each of our, you know, two dozen plus bureaus? Because otherwise we're going to run into this in every audit, right? I mean, I've seen this literally in every single audit I think I've read in 4 years, that we're not collecting required data. And for whatever reason, it gets pushed to the side. How do we stay ahead of it, as opposed to just hearing about it after the fact? What are other jurisdictions doing?
Well, and you know, in this case, for these enhanced services district, it doesn't really require some kind of a fancy, you know, data management system. It's really a matter of collecting these reports and these, you know, budgets and services, and having them available to city commissioners and the public if they're asked for it, and to really just have a centralized someone that can provide some kind of a consistent oversight and collection of those reports.
Where do you think that should reside?
About data. Yeah.
I mean, I could actually see the legal counsel being the appropriate place for this to reside. That's where all the contracts end up. I mean, where do you have some recommendation for us on how we might go about this?
No, we didn't make any recommendations on that. We really, our main recommendation is that council go back kind of to the drawing board and look at the purpose of these districts. What do you want from these districts? That's really your first task, is to sort of develop the purpose. What should these districts be doing? How should they look? How inclusive, how transparent should they be? And then once you have that in place, is then look at, you know, draft the contracts that are gonna reflect that purpose and the mission of those districts. Yeah, so that's really the first task, yeah.
Okay, good advice, I appreciate it. Commissioner Udaly has her hand up again, I think, or no? Nope, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I think back in the 80s when Clean and Safe was actually passed by the city council, I'm sure that there's almost nobody around that remembers how that actual contract was developed. But having said that, it is really clear that there's been no oversight, and I honestly don't blame our financial director, because in fact that is not their job. They don't do that for any other dollars that they collect and distribute. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder why there wasn't a warning sign, 20 years ago, that data that was expected actually didn't show up, right? So it is very troubling to me that we've just kind of been just collecting money and giving it to a program, and we just keep renewing it every 10 years without any due diligence around what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate. I continue to have a concern about paying for police and paying for DAs, because again, I don't get to do that in my neighborhood. And just because people downtown have more money than I do, doesn't mean they should have more access to policing services or to DA services than I do. And so the timing is absolutely perfect on this audit, because yes, Clean and Safe comes up next year. And then the Lloyd Center comes up the year after. And I do believe that what we've done at the Central East Side Industrial Council could be a model that we adopt moving forward for any new or any reauthorized enhanced service districts. Thank you. I really appreciate the work that you've done. And again, I don't blame the finance department, but somebody's responsible for not getting us the data that we as a council way back when said we were supposed to get. So I appreciate your work on this and giving us an opportunity to correct this before we approve any additional enhanced service districts. And I think the question may, we need a longer conversation about ESDs in general. And as you said, Alexandra, what is their purpose? And I will just put on the record today, I have no interest in allowing private businesses to hire Portland police so that they can subsidize private security. So that change will be in the works as we move forward. I think there are other changes that need to be made as well. Thank you.
So if there are no more questions on enhanced service districts, I think we're gonna see some of the same themes we were just talking about in our next audit, which is about the social equity construction
contract. One moment, I'm sorry, Madam Auditor. Commissioner Ryan, are you trying to get in here? It looks like you may be.
Yeah, I'll just real quick, thank you. That was a great report, it was really succinct. My question is, have you compared ESDs, I wanna make sure I got the acronym right, with other municipalities around the country? Is there any best practices out there that we know of?
We have not compared them with other municipalities because the districts are so very different in just about the city that you look at. One thing we did look at is, for example, Colorado and California, the states themselves have laws that direct more of the governance and should be managed. So for example, how the board of directors should be selected. Okay. That's something that Oregon and the city of Portland doesn't have. So So yeah, there are other places that have more of a prescriptive sort of guidance and even laws in place to direct these districts, yes.
Well, that's helpful to hear about the states of Colorado and California.
And do we have our ESD boards? Do we have boards other than, I know right. We have one in the Central East Side, but do we have one, the other two have boards as well?
Yes, they do.
Okay, well, thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, because you wouldn't know that when you were listening to this report.
No.
The overall lack of accountability, who's on first, was just kind of mind-blowing. So thank you.
Okay, Elizabeth Pape will kick us off for the construction contracting audit.
Hi, everyone. Get my presentation going. Is everyone seeing my screen now?
Yeah, it looks good.
Okay. So my name is Elizabeth Pape, and I'm a performance auditor. I was the auditor in charge of the equity and construction contracting audit, and Gordon Friedman was the other auditor on the team. We're here to discuss an audit we released earlier this month on Portland's programs to promote equity through construction contracting. Our audit objectives were to determine whether the city's initiatives to promote equity through construction contracting constitute a coherent system, and also to perform a more in-depth review of the prime contractor development program and the subcontractor equity program. Portland adopted a suite of programs in 2012 to use the impressive purchasing power of City Hall to correct race and gender disparities in construction contracting. The programs provide opportunities for owners of state-certified, socially disadvantaged businesses to build projects worth tens of millions of dollars, for women and people of color to learn a trade, and for city government to make Portland a fairer society. The city had five initiatives to promote equity in contracting. The subcontractor equity initiatives set aspirational goals for prime contractors to hire certified subcontractors. The workforce training and hiring initiative set aspirational goals for contractors to increase workforce participation by women and people of color and hire apprentices. Workforce and contractor diversity grants provide business and workforce development grants funded by 1% of a project's hard construction costs. This became the Community Opportunities and Enhancement Program in 2018. Alternative bid contracting initiative uses a community equity and inclusion plan or a community benefits agreement for public improvement projects more than $10 million. The contracts provide the best value rather than the lowest bid. Contracts prescribe processes to meet contractor and workforce diversity goals and include input from a community-led problem-solving committee. And lastly, the Prime Contractor Development Program supports the development of certified contractors through training and technical assistance and by limiting competition on prime construction contracts less than $1 million to participating firms. Today, we're going to share our audit results and recommendations with you. We're just going to provide an overview of the details included in the report because we want there to be time for questions and discussion. We'll share our audit results with a focus on the Prime Contractor Development Program, which we saw waste mismanagement and barriers within. The procurement process, which had a lack of oversight that made the procurement process less fair. Perceptions of favoritism in communication with vendors and barriers to increasing the diversity among construction contractors and workers in Portland. And we'll save room for discussion, so we haven't included all the information we gathered, and we'll tell you where to look for more. There's a strong narrative of dissatisfaction with the city's construction equity programs among stakeholders. These include minority contractors, advocates, organizations involved in workforce training, and Bureau of Construction project managers. But procurement's actually doing well according to the goals that guide its work. This slide shows the city's goals for subcontractor equity and workforce training and diversity, along with actual performance. The goals are listed here on the right, and then the actual performance is on the left. Procurement is exceeding some of the goals, those marked in green, and close on the ones they are not, which are marked in red. Procurement is meeting its goal for minority and women subcontractors, 15% with a goal of 14%. But if you include emerging small businesses in the goal, they're not meeting the goal. So the goal when emerging small businesses are included is 20%, and they're at 19%. Procurement is exceeding the goal for people of color working on job sites. They're at 30%, where the goal is 14%. It's meeting the goal for apprentices on work sites, but it is not quite meeting the goal for women workers on work sites. There are some problems with these goals and data that we'll talk more about later in the presentation. For example, there's no goal for prime contractor participation, and the data is not disaggregated, so there are disparities within the data for certain groups. If you want more detailed information on these metrics, there are interactive reports online, and we'll provide links at the end of the presentation. But this slide shows that city staff are influenced by goals they set and will move programs to meet those goals. So if you want more progress on equity, there's a good chance that changing the goals will help. And now Gordon's going to talk about the Prime Contractor Development Program and some issues within procurement processes.
Hello, I'm Gordon Friedman with the City Auditor's Office. And the first program we'll talk about is the Prime Contractor Development Program. We'll talk a little bit about the background of the program, what we found, and then our recommendations. And the purpose of the Prime Contractor Development Program essentially is to unlock contracting opportunities for certified firms. Those are women-owned firms, minority-owned firms, and emerging small business firms. And the way that the program unlocks these opportunities is by limiting bidding on prime construction contracts valued at $1 million or under to a pool of companies that are pre-approved by procurement services. The program also provides training and technical assistance to participating companies in order to enhance their business skills. On the next slide, we can get into the results. Something that we did with the audit is gather evidence to see who's winning contracts through the program, and that is what this chart shows. The dollars awarded to minority and women-owned companies were about equal at $21 million for each group. But companies owned by white men also earned a significant amount through this equity program as well, $12.2 million. Overall, white-owned companies won most of the contract dollars awarded via this equity program. And on the next slide, we can see that the amount won by white men through this program was almost as much as these six other demographic groups combined: African-American men, Asian-Pacific men, and so on. On the next slide, we'll see another interesting piece of information. Of course, one of the primary goals of this program was to help the businesses that participate in it become prime contractors on city jobs. But the program we found did not help most participants become prime contractors. And of the companies that participated in the program, more than half never won a contract through it. On this slide, we can actually demonstrate why the Prime Contractor Development Program works as a greater barrier to contracting equity. And if we look at this chart, the top bar, the lightest bar, shows the current number of state-certified construction companies located in the Portland metro area and the Upper Willamette Valley. There's 564 companies that are theoretically available to work on these jobs because they're certified by the state as women-owned, minority-owned, or emerging small business. But if we compare that number to the middle line, the darker orange line, that line shows how many companies are currently allowed by procurement to compete for contracts via the Prime Contractor Development Program. And there's a big drop-off from 564 companies down to 27. Then we compare that to the bottom line, the darkest line, shows that of the 27 companies approved by procurement to bid on contracts through this program, only 10 have ever won a contract. And this is an illustration of an equity barrier. We have a large group of certified construction firms, but a small number of them that are allowed to compete for these contracts. And of those that are allowed, less than half have actually won a contract. And on this slide, we'll show how procurement services did not follow some important program rules. As I said earlier, the program works by requiring contracts $1 million and under to be bid to certified firms. And there are exceptions to that rule, but they're narrow. A bureau must demonstrate a good reason for awarding the contract outside the program, such as an emergency or the unavailability of contractors. And approval to award the contract outside of the program is at the discretion of the chief procurement officer. Our review of the contracting data showed that procurement awarded $33.6 million in eligible contracts outside of the program. And that's the sum of the blue and gray bars on this chart. But of those contracts awarded outside the program, contracts worth at least $18.2 million were awarded outside the program without approval from the chief procurement officer. And those contracts are represented by the blue bars on this chart. As you can see, Parks and Recreation was the top in this category. Awarding these contracts outside the program without approval violated city rules. It also potentially withheld opportunities for wealth generation and experience from program participants. And on the next slide, we'll talk about a couple of other issues, waste of city funds and a lack of monitoring. First is the wasted funds. We found that the program's spending on technical assistance was arbitrary. Some businesses that participate in this program received a lot of help worth tens of thousands of dollars, and others received none for reasons that were not clear. Procurement also spent tens of thousands of dollars providing assistance to companies that were not eligible for that help because they were not in the program. Procurement also spent $230,000 buying a training program that it did not appear to help participants, and it was marketed to the participants as providing a graduate degree when it did not. Procurement also spent money on consultants in ways the public likely would not approve of. For example, the program's manager retired and moved to the Midwest, but was quickly awarded a contract to work as a consultant to the program. Separately, another consultant was hired despite an apparent conflict of interest, and another consultant was awarded a $500,000 contract in violation of city rules. On to monitoring, procurement did not effectively keep track of what was going on with this program. It did not have a master list of companies participating in it. It did not track its spending on technical assistance thoroughly. It did not track which companies were doing well and which needed help. And in addition, City Council directed procurement to set program performance goals, but procurement never set those goals. Council had also directed procurement to give the City Council regular progress updates, but it did not do that either. Many of these programs are longstanding, and we identified them in an audit of this program's precursor, which was published more than 10 years ago. So now on to our recommendations. First, we recommend that procurement expand access to contracting opportunities for certified construction firms by removing the barriers we identified. What we recommend is that procurement simply bid contracts $1 million and under to certified firms. This is similar to how contracts are awarded currently, but it would vastly expand the number of women and minority-owned firms able to bid on city construction jobs. Next, procurement should eliminate the ineffective technical assistance programs. The audit evidence shows procurement has not been able to make these programs work over a more than 10-year period, and City Council has already assigned Prosper Portland the role of administering business technical assistance programs. We recommend that procurement let Prosper handle that work. Next, we recommend procurement work with interested parties such as the Fair Contracting Forum to set a goal for the use of certified prime contractors on city construction projects. And procurement should track and report progress on that goal to council and the public. As Elizabeth noted earlier, there is evidence that setting goals for use of certified firms does improve equity. And finally, procurement should follow the existing rules for documenting and approving exemptions to the program bidding requirements. Next section, we'll talk about some contracting integrity issues we identified that can make contracting less fair or equitable. We'll talk about collusion and bid rigging, project bundling, and state certification, sometimes called COBID, not to be confused with COVID, the virus. We just call these certified firms. And then we'll talk about our recommendations. The first item is collusion, or sometimes called bid rigging. The city has anti-collusion provisions in its construction contracts, but it does not enforce them. We found opportunities to break these provisions as well. For example, we found relatives who own separate companies had the opportunity to bid on the same contracts, which would violate the anti-collusion affidavits. Next, onto project bundling. Project bundling is the process of tying together separate but related projects to achieve efficiency, for example, by grouping small projects together if they're located in the same area of the city. And this can save money, but it can also affect contract equity if bundling is used to keep projects out of equity programs. Council has directed procurement to create a criteria to eliminate bundling, but procurement never did. And next, on to state certification. We found procurement and officials in other bureaus were aware of allegations of certification fraud, but they did not act on them, even though there is a process to investigate and take action. And through the course of our audit work, we also identified specific examples of firms that appeared to be questionably certified. We passed on our evidence about these companies to procurement and the city attorney's office and requested an investigation. In the first case, we found a white male-owned emerging small business firm had graduated from certification, but appeared to reform itself under a new name to again qualify for the city's contracting equity programs. In another case, we found a woman-owned company that appeared to have close ties to the owner's father. The certified firm was owned by the woman and has performed millions of dollars of jobs as a subcontractor to the non-certified firm owned by her father. We found the state initially declined to certify this company, but later did certify them after allowing the company to correct the circumstances that made it ineligible. And later, a state compliance official said it was their opinion that this firm broke the law, but the state certification agency did not take further action. Lastly, we found a person who has two construction companies, one is certified and one is not, and attempted to have the non-certified company subcontract with the certified company. In essence, this person tried to subcontract with themselves to achieve equity goals. And what's the effect of this? It's that legitimately certified companies can lose out on contracting opportunities through the city. So our recommendations in this area. First, we recommend procurement appoint a procurement inspector to monitor, investigate, and report on any purchasing issue that they find relevant, whether that's a complaint of certification, whether that's rules being followed on other city projects, or anything else they find relevant. Next, we recommend that procurement collect data and use data that's already available to it about the prices that are submitted for bids. And this would allow procurement to monitor for bid rigging. And lastly, we recommend that procurement follow City Council's directive to create a criteria to prevent project bundling. I'll now turn it back over to Elizabeth. Thank you.
Gordon. Next, we'll talk about perceptions of favoritism. Procurement staff worked hard to build relationships with organizations such as the National Association of Minority Contractors and the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs. But in prioritizing relationships with some organizations, other organizations and their members felt left out. There was also an inconsistent approach to information sharing about upcoming projects. For example, some procurement staff members introduced select minority contractors to high-level bureau staff. The lack of a uniform approach to information sharing frustrated some contractors who told us that the city played favorites by providing special access to information. Procurement tried to mitigate the perception of favoritism by creating an online list of upcoming projects, but the list was not updated for more than a year. These are recommendations to overcome perceptions of favoritism. Procurement should centralize outreach and create formal outreach procedures that ensure fairness to all participating contractors. All staff performing outreach to certified firms should report to the chief procurement officer. Procurement should formalize tracking of project communications from staff, regularly assess whether communication is fair and transparent. And procurement should ensure that bureaus post upcoming projects on procurement's website. Next, we'll talk about workforce diversity. We touched on procurement's equity goals in an earlier slide, but procurement did not do a good job of reporting progress towards goals. In addition to not providing reports since 2017 and inconsistent reports prior to that, it also did not do a good job of providing information to council and bureau decision makers that could be used to improve equity outcomes. For example, until last spring, it didn't disaggregate data on workforce. The city is meeting its goal of having more than 20% of workforce on job sites as apprentices, but there are disparities within that data. So the chart on the left shows that overall, the workforce is composed of 21% of apprentices, with the rest being regular employees. But among Black workers, 50% are at the apprentice level, and among women workers, 36% are at the apprentice level. This may indicate that Black and women workers are having trouble transitioning from the apprentice stage to full-time workers. Women and people of color are also disproportionately working in lower wage positions like flaggers and laborers. The chart in the middle shows a comparison of men and women who work as all laborers, all workforce, and as flaggers. Women make up 57% of flaggers, but only 8% of the overall workforce. And then the chart on the right side shows the proportion of people of color working as equipment operators compared to people of color working as laborers. People of color make up 36% of laborers, but only 16% of equipment operators. And to put these numbers in context, flaggers make $31 an hour and laborers make $36 per hour compared to $58 per hour for equipment operators. Procurement also doesn't report on known barriers to increasing contractor diversity at the city. Both Bureau and procurement staff are well aware that certain types of projects had few certified contractors to compete for work, including paving, park trail work in sensitive areas, cured-in-place pipe, and fiber optic cable. A lack of certified contractors was the primary reason for project exemptions we showed you from the Prime Contractor Development Program, but it also led to exemptions from subcontractor equity goals. Procurement did not report these barriers, and the city did little to develop capacity among certified contractors to perform this work. In order to increase the diversity of people and contractors working on projects, the city sets aside 1% of construction project costs for workforce training and technical support to contractors. But the program funded by this money has moved in fits and starts. The city first started in a 2012 pilot using this fund in a 2012 pilot program that allocated funds for specific projects. But an evaluation of that program found high overhead costs, limited impacts on the demographics of workers and contractors on the projects, and that the program was susceptible to conflicts of interest. In 2018, the city created the Community Opportunities and Enhancement Program to pool the funds for all projects and disperse grants through a standing committee. The city requested applications from organizations and received 39, but then decided to not award any grants. In 2020, 2 years after it was first created, the city moved the program to Prosper Portland. Prosper Portland began implementation of the program after our audit period ended, so its work was not included in this review. Though the agreement between the city and Prosper Portland provides a better mechanism for oversight, success is not guaranteed. Given this context, it is especially important for Prosper Portland to issue progress reports as required by the agreement, chiefly those that measure equity outcomes. And it's also important that procurement carefully evaluate and act upon information provided in the reports if necessary. These are our recommendations for overcoming barriers and growing capacity. Procurement should produce public reports on the city's progress towards contracting equity goals, including the use of disaggregated data when it helps to explain barriers for subgroups. It should use overall progress and post-project reports to identify trends and lessons learned that can be used to inform technical assistance and workforce grant awards or to develop new policies. And the city should use data to evaluate the results of grant awards on growth in the construction market and report information to council. If you wanted more information on our report, it's available on our website, which is portlandoregon.gov/audit-services/equity-contracting. We also created an online interactive report on data on the subcontractor equity program and the prime contractor development program, which you can access at portlandoregon.gov/audit-services/contracting-dashboard. And procurement has also created an interactive report with workforce training and diversity data, which you can access at portlandoregon.gov/BRFS/4225. And also feel free to email me and Gordon if you have any questions, and we can answer any questions you might have about the report.
Thank you. Colleagues, Commissioner Udaly.
Oh yeah, I've got some questions. First of all, thank you for that scintillating audit. I think you saw me shaking my head, holding my head in dismay, also laughing because you've got some retro clip art in your presentation, including a floppy disk, which I think is the embodiment of a big part of what's wrong with this system is our incredibly outdated technology. I don't know if that was on purpose, but I wanted to give you credit for that. This is an issue that I've been following closely since my first election. It was not an area of expertise whatsoever, and I am still learning about it. I wanna make sure that I'm working with the same numbers. In 2016, the city's procurement rate for women and minority business owners was 3% for minority business or contractors and 1% for women. Am I working with the same set of numbers that we're now seeing is around 14% combined?
So our numbers are coming out of procurement's B2G program, which they require all contractors and subcontractors to submit payments into for reporting on subcontractor equity goals. That's a newer software that the city's using. So I think our scope included 2018, all of 2018 through October of 2019.
Okay. I'll have to go back and find. I just want to make sure that I'm not comparing apples and oranges, but I'm fairly certain that even five years ago, the numbers were extraordinarily low. So I want to acknowledge that I think we have made progress.
I think what you're raising a good point is procurement hasn't done a good job of reporting its numbers. It stopped reporting them entirely in 2017. And prior to that, reported different metrics, used different methods to come up with the numbers. So I think consistent and ongoing reporting would really help us all to put this all more into context.
Yes. So, I mean, I'll just start by saying that I imagine that a conversation about procurement is one of the most boring things that many members of the public could imagine, but it's actually one of the most important functions of our government. And our local government and how we spend public dollars is one of the most powerful ways that we can benefit disadvantaged communities. And this isn't charity, it's justice. So I'm a little riled up right now and I have a lot of comments and questions and I'm going to try to go through them quickly. Clearly I'm really disappointed and disturbed by a lot of the findings in the audit. I am, again, cautiously optimistic about the progress and trajectory of PBOT's subcontractor equity performance. But I want to acknowledge that we still have a long way to go before our contracting community reflects the diversity of our full community, which I believe should be the goal that our goals should actually be proportionate to the demographics of our city. So even the aspirational goals we have right now, I feel are inadequate. I'm gonna skip over the PBOT comments. So I'm glad to see that one of the recommendations involves procurement services producing public reports on the city's progress towards contract equity goals, including the use of disaggregated data by racial identity and gender identity. That's something that my colleague, Commissioner Hardesty, has been asking for consistently. I think in every single instance that we're talking about procurement, And I'm sure she's tired of asking, so let's just make that happen. And I'm wondering if anyone can explain or justify to me why emerging small businesses are even part of this equation. Great if we can disaggregate, but the real goal is investing in women and minority contractors. So that's my first question. Does anyone know the answer to that?
I think that's probably a best question to go to the city attorney.
Okay.
I believe it has something to do with with the way of setting up a program to make sure that it's not race and gender based.
Okay. I'll get to that a little bit later. The level of manual effort required with the systems available at the time is unsustainable. So we're trusting that procurement services will lead development of a citywide methodology to disaggregate this data to make it available. I really look forward to kind of a new day of providing the city with a more accurate view of the diversity of our contractors and in order to determine where we need to make more intentional efforts to change. I'm going to skip over a lot of comments about PBOT. I do think PBOT's doing an exemplary job relative to some other bureaus, and I want to volunteer our expertise if anyone wants to take a look at kind of what we're doing, including around bundling and unbundling projects. I'm going to have to follow up outside of this meeting because there's just way too many questions and I've been taking notes. So here is one of the big issues I would like to put on the table today. We are able to seek low bid exemption so that alternative contracting methods can account for criteria other than cost. But I know that these exemptions require a great deal of time and effort, and it's not sustainable for each and every project, especially smaller projects. We had a conversation last April in which we briefly touched on a contract equity performance score that could be incorporated into the low bid model. Since then, we've done a little research and it appears as though this would be permissible. I've got the statute right in front of me. I'm not gonna read it, but I will share it with anyone who wants it. The contracting agency can evaluate the bidder's record of integrity, and this language appears to be flexible. So when we keep seeing these contractors win the lowest bids, despite the fact that every time they fail to meet our equity goals, this would be one way to address that, to include record of integrity and contract equity performance score. The question I have is, what is the status of the development of a contract equity score that could be incorporated into our low bid model?
That was not something that we discussed with procurement much. We did make a recommendation that they recognize contractors who have been successful at implementing the goals, and the dashboard that we put together of subcontractor equity participation allows you to break it down by contractor, by project, and by bureau. So if you wanted to show how PBOT's doing well, you can see that there as well.
Okay. And then the next topic I wanna touch on because it's come up is the business of disparity studies and how, while that might sound like a good idea, it could deliver lower, it could set our aspirational goals actually lower than they currently are, which is certainly not something that I would support, but I know that it's challenging to navigate race the race and gender conscious aspect without veering into discrimination. So that's what I would really appreciate the opportunity to implement race and gender conscious contracting practices with hard goals that have teeth. And I think that we can do that. I also think we need to consider accepting self-identification by firms that might not be certified with the state. Doesn't sound like the state is doing the best job of guaranteeing that these contractors are actually in compliance. And then finally, just to wrap up, we're all somewhat implicated in this report, including not just procurement services, but really bureaus throughout the city, and including PBOT. PBOT's engaged with procurement services and having an active conversation to identify next steps. We are working to build stronger relationships with our contracting community, including contract equity advocates and trade organizations who've contributed to conversations associated with the topics addressed in this audit. And in addition to building those stronger relationships, building a stronger forecasting framework to get information about projects and to facilitate more diverse prime and sub-partnerships to build capacity. We're also engaging in discussions to evaluate our internal practices to make sure we are a great bureau and ultimately a great city to work with. So I'm going to be tracking next steps of this audit closely in the coming months. This is an issue that I'm really passionate about, and I just would appreciate any input or support from my colleagues. It's clear that there is enormous room for improvement. And I want to finally say that, as with the audit we heard on ESDs and realizing required work that has slipped through the cracks, I just, this is an extraordinarily huge enterprise, and we inherit assets and deficits, and there is a big problem with City Council making commitments that it never fulfills. And I do believe a lot of the times it's not ill-intentioned, it's things that slip through the cracks, and that there's just simply not enough accountability. So we need to work on that. Thanks for humoring me, everyone. I'm still riled up.
Thank you, Commissioner. Colleagues, can people stick around for another 12 minutes or so? I know Commissioner Ryan and I have the same call with our county colleagues, and Commissioner Ryan, I'm trying to move that to 3:45 so that we have a little extension here, but I wanna make sure that's okay with Commissioners Hardesty and Fritz. Are you okay to stick around for another 12-ish minutes? Commissioner Hardesty, next.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Commissioner Udaly, for your statements. First, I want to thank the auditors. I'm never disappointed when the auditors come out with a report, because it always identifies something that either we didn't know or we knew and needed validation on. On this particular report, there's no surprises in it. Every audit that's been done over the last 30 years show that there are people that know how to game our procurement system, and they are very effective at it. However, having said that, the last three mayors have created programs that were supposed to benefit minority and women-owned contractors, and they all fail. And they all fail consistently because it appears that procurement doesn't have a standardized way in how they do contracting. There are some people in procurement that favor some contractors over others, and it's not just in your audit, but I've had those conversations over and over again. What I wanna know is, why do we continue to focus on the 20% of businesses that are certified by the state, where we know 80% of minority and women-owned businesses don't go through the headache of getting a state certification? Why do we do that?
We didn't look at alternatives to the state certification.
I mean, in my mind, that is the biggest problem that we continue, because we continue to recycle the same people, because we use 20% of our available workforce by only focusing on state certified firms. There's nothing magic about being state certified, except people went through a lot of hoops to get that certification. And again, procurement over and over again has affirmed that only 20% of businesses are state certified. I think we have the wrong people in procurement. I'll just say that right now. I think we need to actually have a huge audit top to bottom of procurement, because I do believe that people are gaming the system. You pointed out some very appalling examples of how people utilize our own system to game it, whether that means hiring their daughter, whether that means starting another firm so they can become certified again. And this is not new. This is only second to policing that I've been advocating on for 30 years in the city of Portland. I've spent a lot of time looking at all the new committees that we put together, the new aspirations. And honestly, the city has never, ever, ever achieved the goals that they have set. But what I see your audit doing is giving us a roadmap of what it is that we consistently do and fail at. And I've already talked to both Tom Reinhart. I talk to Lester way too often, and he knows it. But I have no confidence that the current makeup of what we want. And so I just want that on the public record. Let me also say that with the responses to the audit in my mind were inadequate, because what the audit points out is that different staff don't even know the law around contracting and what they can and cannot do as it relates to holding contractors accountable. And it is clear that certain people in procurement operate differently and outside of what the city council has set as their standard. And some people just honestly are lazy and just aren't willing to do their due diligence and additional work to make sure that other people are getting these opportunities. Major contractors know this, and they laugh at us on a regular basis because we continue to aspire and we don't achieve. I hope I never see an audit that looks like this again at the time that I'm on the city council, because again, this is something that these same minority firms, associations have been saying for 30 years. And for 30 years, we keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. We put it under pretty new names. We put it under new initiatives. But at the end of the day, we have done absolutely nothing to build minority and women-owned businesses. And that is why every time a contract comes in front of the city council, I ask for the disaggregated data. I'm not surprised that they didn't start it until I started asking for it, that they actually started disaggregating the data, because I asked for it at every city council meeting. It is very disappointing to me that we continue to say one thing and we continue to allow city resources to be gamed so that the same white major contractors receive all the benefit and the same people continue to lose. So. Your audit was thorough. I don't have any questions about your audit, but I do have significant questions about how we as a council are going to make sure that this is the last time, because the last three audits of procurement have said the exact same thing. And guess what? Nothing's changed. So to my colleagues, it's our job to fix this, because I don't want to see another audit that says the exact same thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hursty. Commissioner Ryan.
Yeah, real quick. I think first of all, thank you. That was very thorough. I'll be reflecting on it quite a bit. I thought the slide on prime contractor development program, the barriers, was by far the most gripping to me. And was it right to see that only 27 of the 564 are even qualified into that? So that's like a little less than 5%. So the denominator, if you will, is just so bleak. And so what is our action plan to increase that denominator? And, you know, that's all it. And I will say I had one bright spot yesterday. Commissioner Hardesty and I were in a, and Commissioner Fritz were in a meeting about the big wastewater treatment project on Columbia Boulevard. And it was nice to see how many, it was good to see how many apprenticeships are involved in that program, the targets that they're meeting with people of color. And of course, that's the roadmap to actually improve the number of the higher wage jobs. You got to start in the apprenticeship programs because that's the way the industry is set up. So I'm I was pleased about that. On and I was trying to connect the dots from a meeting from yesterday. Anyway, thank you. It's quite grim, and yet it's good that we have a baseline that we can improve from. One thing I was also missing is I'd love to see the following report, like say if there was a report 2 years ago or 5 years ago, if there was comparison data from that one, so we could see what the change has been. I know we were referring to it quite a bit, but it'd be nice to see it in the same audit, please. Thank you so much.
Mayor, if I may respond, answer one of the questions Commissioner Ryan asked, which is around the apprentice. Ryan, we do an excellent job of getting apprentice. We do a really poor job of getting journeymen that are people of color and women. So apprentice always looks good, right? Because that's the lower end of the pay scale.
That's not just a good current trend. That's just, no. Okay.
I'm not impressed by that at all. Yeah, that always happens.
Oh.
I have two things I'd like to say. One on the prime contractor development program and getting rid of that barrier. One of our recommendations is to kind of do away with the requirement that someone is enrolled in the prime contractor development program to have access to bidding on projects under $1 million. Our recommendation was to simply rely on state certification for those projects. But that would take a change in, by council from you to change the requirements for that program. So that's something for you to consider. That proposal does not include the proposal coming from Commissioners Hardesty and Udaley to use some other form rather than state certification. But that would also be an additional thing that you as a council could consider. Oh, and then the other thing you said was, could we compare the data going back in our past audits? And the unfortunate fact is we really can't, because procurement hasn't kept consistent data. So that's something that, again, we want to see. That reporting function is really important. The mayor mentioned that with the ESDs as well. It's just such an important part of oversight is having good data, and it's really up to management of programs to consider that they not only have a job to implement their programs, but also to provide the public and the decision makers with the information that they can use to hold programs accountable.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz.
Just have a comment based on Commissioner Hardesty's comment. That may be that there are apprentices in the community projects. It has not been the case in the city. So I was encouraged by what BES is doing, and particularly in their disaggregating of who was getting those apprenticeships. So thank you, Commissioner Ryan, for raising that interesting project that we heard about yesterday. That's the community benefits agreement. That's the new thing that we're doing. This actually does seem like it has a decent chance of working. And so I appreciate both the audit and the work that's being done in the community and in procurement services.
Very good. Thank you, everybody. I'll entertain a motion.
To accept the report, so moved.
I don't believe the auditor likes us. The auditor doesn't like us to accept the report.
You don't need to take any action.
Sorry, I'm watching the clock.
That's okay. You don't need to take any action.
But Mayor, you and I did talk about having a conversation about transforming procurement. So I look forward to us. I have started those conversations with procurement and Tom Reinhart. But I do look forward to us partnering to make sure that we never get an audit like this again.
No disagreement, Commissioner Hardesty. I think we're in agreement. Madam Auditor, I'll give you the last word. We will simply accept the report by acknowledgement. Madam Auditor, why don't you close this out?
Thank you all for your attention. We reserved a little more time and clearly didn't reserve enough time. So we keep trying to hit that better for good discussion, and we really appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone.
Keelan, could you read 844? I'm going to move that.
Adopt code and administration rules for the Community Opportunities and Enhancements Program.
Item 844 will be rescheduled on November 4th, 10:30 a.m. time certain. Thank you, everybody. Excellent report. Good work to the auditors team. We are adjourned.